Okay, welcome to Derange Podcast number one. We're in 15th of April 2010, and I'm Matt Rowan Moore.
And I'm Ben Wilkinson.
And yeah, basically what we're doing is we're kicking off a new format, which is a podcast for us. We did used to do some sort of video blogs, which you can find on YouTube and MySpace and what have you. But because time's short and we're both really busy, we thought a podcast would be the better format to carry on with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the good thing about the video blogs, and we've got some really good ones on there, so if you check them out, there's ones on the French New Wave of Horror and the slasher genre and all sorts of stuff on there, but we found it is just far too time consuming for what we want to do, so thought podcast more accessible. And
well, from time to time we might still do a video vlog, but we're just, you know, we don't want to be doing that every time we catch up, because we're just going to get massively behind. You know, we've both got jobs to do, and we've both got kind of family responsibilities and things like that, so yeah, in order for us to kind of catch up more often, we thought podcast would be the best way to go.
Yeah. Okay,
cool. So what kind of things can we expect in the podcast then, Ben?
Well, I think what we're going to look at, it's going to be kind of like, if you ever see any of the video blogs, we're going to be kind of following a similar format. We're not going to do a simple, we'll talk about one film, we'll talk about the latest film out this week. What we're going to look at is a different areas of cult filmmaking. So we're going to be looking at different genre types, we're going to be looking at different directors, we're looking at cult films of the past. So it's going to be a kind of different thing every week. So hopefully that should keep the format pretty fresh and exciting, really. We're also, we're going to do a section called Where Are They Now? We're going to look at some of the guys, particularly from horror films of the past and cult films, and talk about what he did and where they are now. So
we got some examples like Fred Decker, Anthony Hickox, Joseph Zito, you know, people like that. People that basically, you know, made some really cool films back in the day, and we kind of kept our eye out for films that they would be making, and all of a sudden they kind of went off the radar.
Yeah.
Get right on down to Reno's for your radiation-free reindeer steaks. Hurry while stocks last.
Yeah, we're also going to have like a movie news segment as well, which is, you know, basically just stuff that kind of comes around on the internet that we hear about, as well as also kind of letting people know what's happening in Sheffield in particular, because obviously Rob Nevitt's got a celluloid screams, so we'll kind of let people know about what's going on there as well. So I think this month there's a screening of Living Dead at Manchester Morgue, isn't there, Ben?
Yeah, it is. Well, there's a couple of things. I know Rob's doing a screening of Rec 1 and 2 as a double bill, and I think we're going to talk about a bit of Rec 2 today, aren't we? And also, yeah, there's a double bill of a bit of Italian horror for the year of Lizard in a Woman's Skin and Living Dead at Manchester Morgue. So it's a pretty cool double bill there. So we'll keep you up to date as to what's happening there for all you people who are sort of local to where we are as well.
And obviously, more nearer the time, we'll let you know about the Celluloid Screams Horror Festival, which sort of Rob runs in sort of Halloween time, which is like 3 days of wall-to-wall horror movies.
Yeah.
So we usually get kind of quite excited about that, sort of the beginning of October. And obviously, once we get nearer that time, we'll let you know a little bit more about that as well. We'll probably get Rob down and
bounce
about it as well.
Why not? Yeah, and I guess the other thing, we'll always, because we've obviously been to a few festivals ourselves as well, so we'll always keep you up to date as to what festivals are going on as well, so you've always got an idea as to what's happening. So we're not going to keep it entirely local as Sheffield, so you guys should know what's going on out there.
And also, we'll be doing a segment called Forgotten Movies, which is basically Ben and I will just delve into the back catalogue of various genre films that have come out, which, you know, basically don't get the recognition that they deserve, or people have kind of forgotten about them completely. So, yeah, we'll be talking about those movies in particular. Obviously, for those of you who heard us on Filmfile podcast a couple of weeks back, we were talking about a book that Ben and I are writing, and obviously the films that we mentioned kind of come from that book. So when we get nearer the time of the book coming out, we'll also inform you of that as well. So we've got plenty of things on the agenda.
Yeah, cool. So I think that's enough about talking what we're going to do, so should we get down to it and talk about what we are going to talk about?
Attention, you are now entering the debarkation area. No talking, no smoking. Follow the orange line to the processing area.
The first segment, we're just going to ease it in this time. What we're going to do, but a review of what's come out so far this year. So what we're going to look at, really, we're just talking about horror this time. So we're just going to look at what the big horror films that have come out. Well, not all big, but all the great horror films that have come out so far. You know, we're going to talk about our thoughts on them and sort of what else we're looking forward to, I guess, in the year.
Should we kick off then with Wolfman? I've not seen it.
No. Wolfman. It's a funny one because it's because Wolfman was filmed near Sheffield as well.
It was indeed, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was filmed in Chatsworth in Derbyshire. So you see the old Chatsworth house there, and you know, it's instantly recognisable. But it's I don't know. I guess were you looking forward to this one?
I think earlier on I was looking forward to it. Yeah, you know, from seeing those early trailers, it looked quite interesting. I like the idea of a kind of gothic horror movie. We've not had one of those for a while. The closest thing I can think of, I'm sure there's been some in between, but I can't think of them, was probably a film that a lot of people like, but I was a bit let down by it, was the Dracula movie, Coppola's Dracula movie.
Yeah.
You know, with the wobbly sets. So, you know, this, I thought, you know, maybe this could have been something slightly better, but obviously, as we know, it was kind of majorly flawed, wasn't it?
It took
a while to come to the theatres. I think it had four or five release dates, and it kept getting pushed back because of different problems. I know the director, Mark Romanek, was attached to the film originally, wasn't he? And
yeah.
I think there was budget kind of complaints and stuff like that, which means that he left and somebody else took over. And again, I think they had to go back and do reshoots like a year and a half later, didn't they?
Yeah.
So it was a problematic shoot. And I think basically from all accounts, from what I've heard from people who have seen the film, is that it kind of shows on screen.
Yeah, it did, because I've been seeing this film, and it's one that it's got all the potential of being a really good film, but there are parts of it, and the reshoots are so obvious in it, because there'll be a scene where somebody's doing something. I remember there's one scene where Emily Blunt's being taken off by Hugo Weaving, and he's like Scotland Yard cronies for some reason trying to lure in Del Toro's Wolfman to find her, and then so she's taken away, and then the next exact scene is her sat at her desk reading a book about werewolves. And it's like, well, what happened, you know, because you end on a dramatic point where she's taken off by these cops. And you don't see what happens.
So we don't even get like a cutaway of a moon or exterior shot of a building or anything.
That's
like
it,
that
just piles into a reading about bloody werewolves. Yeah.
See, forgive me, but I'm not too sold on Emily Blunt either. I think there's far better leading ladies out there. You know, no disrespect to her really, but I don't know. I just thought maybe she was a bit ill cast for
I really like Emily Blunt. I'm really quite taken on her. I think. Have you seen Wind Chill at all?
I have seen Wind Chill.
I love Wind Chill. Yeah. I thought she was good in that. And then,
I know she's in Devil Wears Prada, isn't she?
Obviously, you know.
It's probably my recall there.
That's it. But you know, not every film's a winner. But then it's like she was in The Young Victoria, and you gotta remember this is an American girl, and
you think she's English when you see her.
You
or British,
do. That's the thing. That's the thing. It's like you can see a lot of American actors and actresses, and their English accent is very, very. Mm. You know, it's almost like Queen's English, isn't it? And then with her accent, I think is a lot more subtle, and I think works a lot better. And now I like the girl, and all in all, I thought Wolfman was. Had the potential of good casting.
I think there's also the, you know, obviously I'm a huge Rick Baker fan, and, you know, obviously in my mind, one of the best kind of werewolf movies ever is American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
You know, no one can dispute that. And obviously when he heard about the film being made, he campaigned, didn't he, to do the makeup special effects in the film. And then they agreed to do 100% Rick Baker effects.
Yeah.
And then a little bit later on, it was like, okay, well, you know, 75% and 25% CGI.
Yeah.
And I think that kept changing a little bit. So, you know, maybe I should kind of reserve judgment until I actually see the film. But I've, from all accounts, it sounds like they kind of held back a little bit on some of Rick Baker's special effects.
They did, and the CGI is very, very obvious. And the difference is the Wolfman stuff, where you've got like the guy walking about on a two legs with the ripped shirt, and the.
Does that not feel dated now?
He does, but then in the end, the film is a homage to a large extent, isn't it? So I think it needs to be that sort of style.
Okay. Like it or loathe it?
No, I'm kind of like, I'm in between. It was potentially good, but ridiculously flawed. And, you know, in the end, it was just a shoddily put together film that was thrown out far too quick.
Okay, let's Wreck 2.
Wreck 2, right, okay. Well, for Wreck 2, for people who don't know, obviously it may not have hit the cinema screens yet. Now, for people who've seen Wreck, they obviously know about the situation. And for those who haven't seen Wreck but have seen Quarantine, again, you know the story. And the story
is... Although, shame on you, you really should watch Wreck.
You should, yes, yeah. And Wreck 2... should we give a bit of background about Wreck first of all?
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, I'm sure most of our fans have seen the film, but we'll quickly go over it. You know, in Wreck, you've got a TV show with a host who's attached to these firefighters, I believe, aren't
they?
In the first film. And, you know, basically what they're doing, they're making a TV show about what happens in the dead hours when everyone's asleep. And they do various different kind of professionals. It just happen to be firefighters in this particular show. So basically, the beginning of the film, nothing really happens. They're introduced to the kind of the general cast, and they're just larking around and having a bit of a laugh. And then they get a call. They call out to a building where it seems like some old woman's gone crazy. I don't know why they call the fire department.
Maybe there's a reason for it. But
anyway, they go to this house, this building, which is like got various different apartments in it. And it transpires that, you know, there's some sort of infection going on, and people are a bit rabid. And all in all, it comes across like a zombie movie. Now, the film's all shot kind of first person with the camera crew, and it kind of has that kind of found footage kind of quality, like Blair Witch and Cloverfield and what have you. And it's a really cool film. There's a couple of bits which, you know, I'm always a stickler for this stuff, where the footage is rewound, you know, yet you still get to see it, which obviously in reality that wouldn't happen, and bits and pieces like that. But overall, it's a really, really cool film. And obviously towards the end, that's kind of really when it kicks off, isn't it? The last sort of 10 minutes of the film.
Yeah,
kind of cranks up the fear factor. And basically, yeah, it's a really cool film. Now, the thing with Wreck 2 is it takes place moments after Wreck 1 finishes.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like your ideal sequel, like Halloween. Halloween 2 follows straight on. I mean, to be fair, at the end of Wreck 2, if you wanted to do another hour and 10 minutes, you could, you know, on the same evening. So, you know, imagine if Wreck 2 does well, we probably will see a Wreck 3.
Yeah, I suspect so. And it's good, and I always think that with sequels, you need to stay true to the original, and this is exactly what Wreck 2 does. But what it does, it puts a good spin on the original, and it doesn't rehash anything really from the first one. Albeit it's set in the same
apartment
block. Yeah. It's still got.
You get to see a little bit more though this time.
Yeah,
don't you?
You do. Yeah. And
basically, it completely changes its approach as well.
It does, yeah.
Whereas the first one feels like a viral movie.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest with you, at the end of the first film, I was still thinking of it as some sort of viral movie.
Yeah.
Even though the ending of the first one explains it to you, I kind of missed the explanation.
Yeah.
And it was only watching Wreck 2 that I kind of really took on board the actual possession angle.
Yeah.
Which is what they run with in the second film.
Yeah.
As they say, it's like Aliens meets The Exorcist, isn't it?
That's it. And I guess it must be that, to some extent, that the filmmakers thought when they were making Wreck 1 that they were going to make Wreck 2 because of how well it just flows into the second film. And I guess it's like you're saying, that you, in Wreck 1, you don't think about it as what you see at the end of that is all about possession. You still, like I say, you think about it as a viral film, like something. It's got a very similar feel, I guess, to the remake of Dawn of the Dead, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, exactly. Yeah.
But Wreck 2 does put a completely different spin on it. And I tell you something, when you bring in the idea of possession and some sort of devil and demon,
gives it a darker tone.
It does very much and you know, this is somebody who talking to who isn't particularly Christian at all, but there is something certainly a lot more terrifying when you're looking at people who are possessed by some sort of
I think it just gives it a weightier context.
Yeah,
and I think obviously we're all zombie filmed out at the moment as well. You know, we kind of know the rules to zombie films. We've kind of seen every single angle on a zombie film. So to take a zombie film and then kind of spin it around into more of a possession type movie, I think that's certainly where it kind of gains points.
Yeah.
What did you think about the lead sort of... I mean, I'm not going to give spoilers away, but it's pretty obvious this guy's a priest before he's revealed.
Yeah.
But essentially, what did you think of him?
Oh, no, I thought all the acting, again, was very solid. I like the girl from the first one who appears in this one as well. So, unfortunately, I just realised I've just given that away. But I think the acting across both films is very solid. Obviously, when you get in a translation between a foreign language and English film, then you do potentially lose something in the way that lines of dialogue are delivered.
Yeah.
Because you don't necessarily realise the emphasis of tone perhaps so much because you are reading subtitles.
Yeah.
But all in all, it comes across as a solid piece of acting all around.
I really enjoyed the guy. What I thought about the first film, again, kind of popped up in the second film. If I had watched those performances in my native language of English, some of it might have been a little bit comical.
Yeah.
Like, I remember there's certain characters in the first film that are talking about different characters, and there's a Chinese guy, and because it's in Spanish and everything, you kind of take it verbatim, and, you know, I don't know, you kind of just listen to his story, and it's not really funny. Yet had he been speaking in English and stuff, he would have been a bit more of a caricature.
Yeah.
And again, I thought that was the same with the second film, and in that, you know, because it was Spanish, I kind of took it a bit more seriously.
Yeah.
Whereas if it was perhaps like in a quarantine, you know, two,
yeah.
I would have been laughing a little bit more at the certain performances and stuff like that, because it comes off a little bit tongue in cheek at places.
Yeah.
But you know, not enough for you to detract from the film, but you know, certainly it was kind of there. So all in all, Wreck 2, I don't know, it gets a good thumbs up from
it. Yeah, it really does. I think it's hard to follow on from a good first film.
Yeah.
And I think they accomplished that, and I would say it's certainly on par with the first one, if not slightly better.
I'd say it's slightly better,
yeah.
To be honest, yeah, I would. Although, you know, I won't give anything away, but the ending, you know, it's kind of a talking point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see what people think about the ending for Wreck 2.
You now have the option to terminate and be cremated on the premises. If you elect this option, notify the duty sergeant in your processing area.
All right, let's move on to something else that I haven't seen, which is House of the Devil.
House of the Devil, right, okay. And I think that this is probably... We put this on the list, and I think we probably should mention this by now, is that the films that we picked up on that we're going to be talking about are kind of general films that have either been released on disc or have had brief appearances at the cinema this year.
Now, you saw this film at Celluloid Screams Festival last year, didn't you?
I did, yeah. And I think House of the Devil's been doing the rounds at the festival circuit for quite some time. But it's only just come out in the UK on DVD in the past few weeks. And I do believe it had a brief cinema release as well.
What's interesting is obviously it's come out on Blu-ray, but it's also come out on VHS as well.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a coup.
It's a great selling point.
Because no one's releasing film on VHS at the
moment. No, it's a great selling point, and I think this is a charm of this film. And if anybody, for those of you who haven't seen it, I'll briefly synopsise the film. It's about a young girl who is hired to babysit for one night, and she's desperate for money to get into a house to help support her tuition at college. And so she goes over to this house and thinks, okay, we're going to be babysitting. But it turns out it's not babysitting. We're actually going to be looking after an elderly relative for a night. And so, you know, as she's more hesitant, the price goes up. And eventually, you know, $600 for one night's work or something of that nature. So she's on board with that. And yeah, what the vast majority of this film boils down to is the young girl in the house and the atmosphere of and the tension of what's kind of not going on there. And so it's her walking about and just examining things, but yet the tone of the film, the darkness, the lighting, the music, they all kind of bring you in as though something's going on quite underneath, but yet You don't see anything till much later on. So it's
split people, hasn't it, this film?
It's a massively split.
I think people. If you're kind of like, you know, a Saw aficionado and you like your gore and your set pieces and the movie kind of ticking along with fast edits here and there, you're going to be a little bit disappointed with this film.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you're an old school horror fan and you like those kind of late 70s, early 80s atmosphere films where, you know, and you know, kind of subtleties of filmmaking, then you'll probably appreciate where this film's coming from.
Oh, absolutely. It's got a right feel of... if you ever go back and watch Chainsaw Massacre and you think about how slowly that film builds up, and House of the Devil, I must admit, builds up far slower than Chainsaw Massacre, which may put a lot of people off, but in the end you think about how engaged you were with Chainsaw Massacre at a point where Marilyn Burns is getting hit over the head with a hammer, and that's because the film has drawn you in very, very slowly. And this is exactly what House of the Devil does. It's a film which... it's all about mood, it's all about atmosphere, and there's very, very little narrative in it. It would easily make a 10, even 15 minute short film. And
I'm looking forward to seeing it. You're lending me it tonight then, Ben.
We'll see.
It's also got Tom Noonan in it.
Yeah,
well. I'm a big fan of Tom Noonan.
Yeah, the great Tom Noonan. Yeah. He's fantastic in it. He's just... a smallish part, but yet it's so well delivered. It's so well cast, just because the size of the guy just gives this, like...
He's got a great look, hasn't he?
Yeah,
Tom,
yeah,
he
has. Yeah. Fantastic.
I mean, if you don't know who we're talking about, obviously he was Frankenstein in the Monster Squad.
Yeah.
He was obviously the kind of the serial killer in Manhunter, which is a great, fantastic performance, which really kind of like brought him to the forefront for most people. And what I always remember him as is the kind of crazy guy with an axe in Last Action Hero.
Oh, right. Yeah,
I always think of Tom Noonan
that.
And then a crazy Mac with an axe, so that's kind of what I think of. But yeah, I've got a lot of time for Tom Noonan. So House of the Devil, I'm really looking forward to seeing it. Obviously, you think it's a good film.
Yeah, big thumbs up.
And it's quite interesting to hear what kind of came from Ty West, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Because I did catch The Roost when it came out, and I must admit I was bored by that.
I've never seen The Roost.
Yeah,
so.
Again, obviously it came out a few years ago, and it was kind of like heralded as this movie, you got to see it from this, you know, this new guy in the horror field, and I was pretty disappointed by that film. It was quite boring, and not much going for it, so obviously I was kind of intrigued to see House of the Devil. Now, speaking of Ty West, this is another film that I've not seen. I have to explain why I've been so lame. I had a little boy 6 months ago, and just getting around to watching a lot of these horror films compared to back in the day when I used to watch loads of movies all the time. It's quite hard, but I've promised Ben that I will catch up with the backlog for the next vlog that we do, the next podcast. But yeah, go on, tell us a little bit about Cabin Fever 2.
Cabin Fever 2. And to be fair, I must admit, I'm only halfway through this film. I'm watching it in batches. And this is another film by Ty West, who directed House of the Devil. I think there's a slight more story behind
it. He's kind of disowned this film as well, hasn't he?
He has, yeah, very much so. I think there's been a lot of issues with the with the production company, with the distribution company, and I think in the end, the film that's probably out there isn't the film that Ty West wants, which is interesting. And when you look at it and you compare it to something like House of the Devil, it is very different. And certainly tonally it's massively different, but then by the same token, what you're looking at, and the one thing I've gathered from Cabin Fever 2, is that here's a guy who just loves horror films, and every scene is a bloody homage to something or other. And I think it's when I've been watching it, it's become so blatant that it's almost become slightly annoying that he's doing it. And even within the first 5 minutes of Cabin Fever 2, you see the main guy from the first Cabin Fever come out, and he gets hit by a truck, and it's...
Who is it? Let's party, is it that?
No, but the party guy's in it.
Okay,
But the main guy in the first Cabin Fever, he gets hit by a truck, and...
Oh, like, Ryder Strong.
Is it Ryder Strong?
Yeah, is it something like that?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a cool name.
Yeah, I know.
I think it is Ryder Strong.
Yeah. Well, he's hit by a truck and basically bursts into this bloodbath all over this school bus. And he straight away, as soon as I saw it, and I just thought, that's RoboCop all over. And for the next next 10 scenes out of that, you could pick out at least 4 or 5 that seem to just be homages to film. Mm. And I'm all for it.
Yeah, see, sometimes that can be really fun because we're kind of like that ourselves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But then equally, if you're getting too many in one movie, yeah, it can maybe be a bit distracting.
This is it, yeah. It's like, if you look at something like House of the Devil, which is much more of a very subtle nod, perhaps, to the films of the 70s, but then Cabin Fever 2 just seemed like, right, I like that scene from RoboCop, so I'm just going to recreate it here, just because it looks cool. Mm. And
whether it fits or not.
Yeah, this is it. And I think when you're a film fan, those things blatantly stand out.
Mm.
But then again, you know, this is a guy like ourselves who just loves horror films, so I don't want to knock him too much for it. But
he's made a film that you can only watch in parts.
Well, you know.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Okay, so that, you know, that's not necessarily, we're not necessarily run out and catch this film.
No, I mean, I've still got a lot of time for it, and it's a funny one because I'm still a reasonably big fan of the first one, and I know a lot of people aren't, and it seems like...
I look back on it now with fondness. Again, it was one of them. I think, you know, what you got to remind yourself is when these films come out, they're always surrounded by hype, and the expectations are massive. I remember actually seeing Cabin Fever. I think, well, that was... Would we both see it?
Yeah, we saw it at Fright Fest.
Fright Fest in London, yeah. And, you know, obviously it was, you know, we heard all about this bidding war that had happened on this indie horror film that was kind of came from executive producer.
Yeah, David Lynch.
Yeah. And then there was a little 10-minute video from this kind of, like, ape-looking guy. Little were we to know that he kind of likes younger girls. We're just having a giggle because he's been pictured going out on the town with Peaches Geld. No, was it Peaches Geld?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't read Heat magazine.
Well, so. It wasn't in Heat, it was in other Sunday papers.
Oh, right, okay.
But we're giving a bit of stick because he's about 15 years younger than him. But anyway, regardless, you know, it was supposed to be the latest big thing. We're talking about Eli Roth here, obviously. You know, obviously he was responsible for the first film, and at the time I was a little bit let down by it. But obviously,
well, I can remember us quite enjoying that. I came out and I thought Cabin Fever was a great film,
yeah.
And my feelings really haven't changed for that film.
I think if you just stumbled on it, I think you'd think, well, this is a really cool film. But I think the fact that it was like, you know, this is going to be the new Evil Dead. Now, you know, Evil Dead's like the holy grail for horror fans, and to have any film kind of compared to that is bound to be a letdown, let's be honest.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, I felt at the time that the kind of crazy dialogue and stuff was just stuck in there because Lynch produced it. It kind of felt a bit off-kilter with the rest of the film.
If you remember that Eli Roth was saying that in the end, Lynch had barely nothing to do with
apart
it.
Apart from some money or something. Or his name, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just his name. Because I remember actually Eli Roth just saying that David Lynch said, use my name like a credit card and just go out there and get it funded that way. Which I think he did. And
to be fair, it's not a bad film.
No,
it's just not the great thing it was kind of supposed to be.
Yeah, no, I do have a lot of time for Cabin Fever. The second one, yeah, it's okay so far from what I've seen from the first half. It's okay.
Go on.
I was going to say, perhaps I'll update you in later weeks as to
when you've got to the end of it.
Yeah, when I've got to the end of it.
Why didn't you pull the trigger?
Okay, let's talk about a movie which I loved this year, and to be fair, it's my film of the year so far. We're only 3 months in, but again, it was a film that, God forbid that I say it, I actually think it's better than the original. It's The Crazies.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, me and you went to see this at the Flicks, which, you know, number one, you know, I end up watching a lot of movies at home these days, and to get me to go to the cinema is kind of like a rare thing. I am one of those suckers now, it kind of only really goes to see something in 3D, like Avatar or something like that, but
3D hall.
Yeah, but you know, I did go and see The Crazies, and I loved it. I must admit, I thought it was fantastic. It was a real throwback to sort of old school horror filmmaking, with some really good set pieces in it. And I've since read, basically, there's a particular scene in mind that I liked, which they've said now, obviously, they wanted to, you know, do for car washes what Psycho did for the shower.
Yeah.
And I think that certainly worked.
Yeah.
One of the, you know, obviously, I'll let Ben fill you in on the plot in a minute. I'm just jumping straight in there to cool scenes.
Yeah,
there's a really cool scene scene in a car wash where I won't spoil it for you, but it's really tense, and the kind of the whole the water going over the windscreen and the kind of the buffers going around really creates the tension, and you can't quite see what's going on, and it's all kind of amplified and escalated in a really kind of skilled way.
Yeah.
I don't know too much about what this guy had done before, the director. Apparently he'd done Sahara. Some kind of other mainstream movie.
Yeah.
But obviously he's turned his talents to horror filmmaking here, and 10 out of 10. You know, I see it, to be fair, I actually enjoyed it more than the Dawn of the Dead remake. I think it's slightly more of a solid film than that.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, I really enjoyed The Crazies.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
Do you want to mention about the original and the old Romero?
Yeah, I will do. Obviously, for those of you who don't know about The Crazies, it's a remake of an old George A. Romero film, also by the name The Crazies. George A. Romero made the Living Dead film, so Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead. And so he's...
And this was just after Night of the Living Dead, this film, wasn't it?
The original Crazies was...
I think it was certainly before Dawn, wasn't it?
It was.
So it was this kind of filling in the sandwich.
Yeah, it was after Jack's Wife and There's Always Vanilla. So really, I think it was... Yeah, it was certainly before Martin as well. So yeah, this was really George Romero's film after The Night of the Living Dead that kind of brought him back into the horror field.
Although it didn't do very well by all accounts.
No, it didn't. Although I think Romero's always been one of those ones, especially with Night of the Living Dead, that it was really originally wasn't taken well in its home country, but yet found its market in the European field, especially in France and Britain. And again, this is like where I think in general films like The Crazies, the original Crazies, it's one of those where it finds critical acclaim, but yet to mass market it's very difficult for
well,
people to buy into.
Again, it's one of those films, no disrespect to the American audiences, I mean, I think as an audience now they're very aware of the political ramifications of the films that Romero made, but back in the day I think it was European audiences that always seemed to understand and appreciate those kind of political comments that Romero was making in his films.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the American audiences just took them as a sort of entertainment level, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why The Crazies kind of fell by the wayside a little bit when it first initially came out.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, obviously, the remake tends to kind of skip over the political issues that were made in Romero's movie.
Yeah, very much so.
And just concentrates on the zombie movie without zombies. It's essentially what it is, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
You know, there's something in the water, and it's changing people and making them go a little bit crazy. And that's essentially what the plot is, you know. You don't have to have any more than that. Now, what I really enjoyed about the film was its constant movement, going from one location to the next. You were never bored. It was just moving from one set piece to the other. And a really good kind of lead performance from Timothy Olyphant, who I'm a big fan of. I think he needs to do more movies. I think when me and Wall saw him back a few years ago in a movie called Go, we were straight away, this guy's really charismatic, you know, he's going to go places. And essentially, you know, everything he's done has been really good, but he hasn't really kind of broke through.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, you know, maybe I don't know if he wants to or whether he's quite happy with the career that he's got, which is just sort of acting.
Yeah, it's a funny one. It's like I think in the films that he does, he's always very good in them. Although he was in Hitman.
I never saw that.
No. Which, to be fair,
was Xavier Gens or Gans.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Which, to be fair, I don't have a problem with the film per se.
Javier, I should say.
Yeah, Javier. I don't have a problem with the film per se. I think it's more that a film like that's very difficult to pull off, and I think
he's a good actor, and you know, to try and do a performance based on two-dimensional characters
might
be quite difficult, you know. But anyway, The Crazies. What else can we say about The Crazies apart from we really liked it?
Yeah, this is. I mean, it's got Rada Mitchell in as well.
I know you're a big fan.
Yeah, I am. Despite from my fan days back when she was in Neighbours, but I like her in Pitch Black and. I'm just trying to think what else she did.
I was only really thinking Pitch Black, but I'm pretty sure she's done other stuff as well.
Yeah, perhaps it's just my Pitch Black obsession.
We need to mention the other guy who, forgive me, I can't remember his name now, but there's another character that's with these two kind of lead characters.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Obviously, he's kind of come from nowhere, but I really liked him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's kind of got a particular style about him, and I think it worked really well.
Yeah.
So, full credit to that guy. Whoever you are, he did a really good job.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I just want to kind of reiterate what you said about it. The pacing of the film is so great because what you end up getting is something that kind of starts off small, and if you're mad, it's almost like throwing a rock into a pool of water, isn't it? Where it starts off with a small, and a couple of events happen where you get some crazy guys in this town doing some weird things, but it just escalates and escalates, and in the end, what you end up is essentially a bit of a chase movie, bit of an escape sort of movie, yeah. But the action set pieces are just fantastic, but with the build-up of tension that leads into those action scenes.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I can only really think of one particularly gory scene,
yeah,
which is still really done really well, but the rest of it, like you say, is far more about tension and building atmosphere than it is about kind of showing you splattery effects or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, it does win on that front. I think, was it a 15?
Yeah.
It might have been a 15, you know, and I don't know if you're a hardcore horror fan, when you see a 15 certificate kind of come up at the beginning of a film, you know, you kind of sometimes
you
think,
do feel a bit disappointed. Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it was one of those films like that really didn't make any difference at all, and, if you know, it is a great film. So, yeah, I think that The Craziest Come was thoroughly recommended.
Great film.
Doing another leap on the Romero front then, we might as well talk about Survival of the Dead.
Yeah.
Wow. Zombies hit Craggy Island, as I like to call it. It really did feel like that to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you got to give Romero credit for pumping these films out, you know, and it seems like people are willing to give him a check with, you know, kind of the amount not filled in, as long as he's making a zombie film. You know, I think if he tries to get any other film greenlit, it just doesn't happen. Where,
yeah.
You know, hey, George, you know, another zombie movie, here's a check, go and make it.
Yeah.
And, you know, more, albeit not very big check. Yeah. It was quite a budget movie, this,
wasn't
it?
They're all independent. Well, from Diary and Survival, we're all independently financed. So there's no production company, no big studio behind this.
I've got to say, I preferred this than Diary of the Dead. I thought that was a god-awful movie. I watched it once, and then I hated it, and I went back to it to try and see if it was a better film, and I hated it again.
Yeah.
And I really don't think I'll ever revisit that film.
Yeah. Do you want to introduce Survival and just tell us a bit about what happens?
Yeah, okay, Survival of the Dead. Can I remember the actual plot? I don't know. Basically, you've got this island with two rivaling kind of semi-Irish blooded families who are on these islands. Basically, one of these old boy Irish guys is kicked off by the other Irish old boy and his family. So what he does, by the way, there's some sort of zombie epidemic breaking out amongst all this. And what he does is he kind of, this guy who's kicked off the island sets up a little kind of video clip where he's on a shore advertising to people that he can take them to this island for safety. And when they get there, basically rips them off.
Yeah.
That's essentially it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then you've got basically like a team of renegades, one of which was in Diary of the Dead.
Yeah, had a cameo in Diary of the Dead.
And it's kind of like, it's his story. Now, again, these guys I really quite liked. I like the girl who was in this group of kind of renegades. I thought she was pretty good.
Yeah.
And the guy was kind of like a budget version of, what's his name from Iron Man? Downey Jr.
Yeah.
He had a budget Downey Jr. quality about him.
I love that, a budget Downey Jr. quality. Yeah.
But, you know, and essentially what these guys try and, you know, survive the city, they get to this port, they come in contact with this old Irish boy who then takes them on a ship to the Island of the Dead, which was probably going to be called, wasn't it? Let's be honest about it.
Yeah, no.
Until someone came up with the idea of calling it Survival of the Dead.
Yeah, no, yeah. Island of the Dead's a great title. Yeah, you know. That would have worked. And
but then once they get to the island, it all kind of goes a bit flat, doesn't it?
It does. It's very strange, this film. It starts off with a good idea, and it's always one of those things that if you ever imagine yourself in the zombie epidemic, and I think this is the thing about Romero's films that we were just talking about, Survival of the Dead, it's all centred around this one zombie epidemic. So if you imagine Night of the Living Dead back in 1968, and then we're looking at Survival of the Dead in 2009-2010, so you're looking at near sort of 40 years of
zombie film,
zombie action. Yeah. But it is all centred around the same period, the same situation. And I think I remember reading a book which was speculating about the timescales within the epidemic. I don't think it is that Romero's making just different zombie films. He's making zombie films that are all set in the same situation.
Yeah.
But obviously, they've been made bloody 40 years apart now.
Yeah.
And I always thought that, you know...
See, I've got to be honest, it brings up a difficult question here as well. It's like, you know, don't get me wrong, Dawn of the Dead is one of my favourite films. I think it's one of the favourite films of many horror film fans. Yeah. But, you know, is it that good because there was nothing else like it when it came out? Is it that good because it blew people away in terms of the length of the movie, the carnage that you saw, and the sort of the political ideas that it was banding around? And is Survival of the Dead just a bit of a lame duck because we've just seen that many zombie movies and there's nothing new going on?
I don't think so, because I think if you look at Land of the Dead, I think that was a film which still holds its weight to a large extent.
It does. I remember we both were very disappointed with that film when we first saw it.
I loved it, yeah.
No. I remember being, again, it was one of them, what, 15 certificate, what, CGI, gore and blood. I remember being really disappointed with that film until, obviously, I caught up with the director's cut DVD, which did make a massive difference.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've come to appreciate and respect that film.
Yeah.
But at the time, I didn't.
But if you think that Land of the Dead was the last studio film that Romero made,
yeah.
I know you look at Diary and Survival, and you can see the difference. And I suspect the difference is probably some guy standing over him going, "No, you've got to do it this way. You know, you can't really reference."
Well, what I thought was really interesting about Land of the Dead was his whole crew were like 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
It probably, obviously, they knew to respect the name George A. Romero, but at the end of the day, you know, how much could they actually, like, you know, work with him?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, he might, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but he might have felt very much like, you know, who the hell am I working with here? Maybe that's where all his iPod and YouTube ideas came from for Diary of the Dead. You might think, shit, I'm working with a different generation here, you know. But yeah, George, you don't have to think like that, you know.
That's it. And I think there's too much of it in Survival of the Dead, isn't there, as well? Yeah. You see a bit where this kid's looking on his iPhone.
They make a big deal out of it, don't they? Yeah.
And it's showing them the video of this Irish guy advertising and coming to this island, and you kind of think, okay, well, surely, have you got any phone networks still up and running?
Yeah,
you know,
it's
just simple things like this, and you're trying too hard to get in it, to shoehorn in these bloody references.
You know, so like what end of the day, what are we saying about it? It's probably good after a few beers on a Friday night.
Well, I mean,
it's no continuation of the legacy of Romero.
No, and I was pretty drunk when I watched it, actually, and I didn't really enjoy it. And I think the funny thing was, it's very much if you ever notice, it's almost like for a few Fistful of Dollars and Yojimbo and Last Man Standing, you know, this idea of playing the two families off against each other. And it very much had that feel, and it was almost...
It didn't work.
No, it did it. It just seemed really quite pointless. It was like putting in another narrative thread that you didn't.
Well, again, like you said,
really,
it's shoehorning. Shoehorning different ideas into the mix.
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, I think maybe he should just stick to his one narrative like he's done with his most successful films.
You got to think, with zombie films, it should be as simple as you put people in one situation, a location, zombies are around. And the idea should be that it's the people involved that create the narrative and create the events, rather than the situations and the circumstances that do it. That's the difference between something like Day of the Dead, which is drama,
the best.
Drama driven. Yeah. And
I'm one of those who thinks Day of the Dead's better than Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, I think Night of the Dead's best, but you know, I'm old school. So, but it is right. It's where a film's drama driven and character driven, and the interaction is the thing that builds the tension. Whereas Survival of the Dead and Diary of the Dead just put us in ridiculous situations
with ridiculous characters.
Yeah, and yeah.
What I will say though is it did have some quite inventive deaths though. I remember chuckling at a couple of the death sequences in those. I mean, I can't recall them now.
No, I can't
recall. But I remember them being quite inventive, put it that way. All right, you've got a couple of minutes to inform us about Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. And I wanted to bring this one in because I think this is going to be my favourite film so far this year. And I think it's probably my most anticipated film so far from the beginning of the year. And it was one of these films that kind of... You've probably seen advertisements for the books on the side of buses now, and
and sitting and hearing about this trilogy of books that have been written. The background of it, it's all based on a Swedish book by an author called Stieg Larsson. Well, I believe he's dead now, I think. You haven't told me about it.
No royalty
checks for him.
I was going to say he's not a relation to the other guy who used to do those animations, but never mind.
Yeah, okay, well, no. And the books are obviously, they do have quite a renowned following in literacy
circles,
yeah. And I think it was one of those where it's always a matter of time before the film got made. And the good thing was that the film got made in its native language, and it was a Swedish film, because I can imagine that if it was...
So it's subtitled, Ben?
Subtitled, yeah.
Is that not going to put off morons from going to the cinema?
I'm sure it will, although there is a dubbed version. But like any foreign film, you have to see it in its native language. You do, otherwise you lose far too much from seeing a dub version. Although, saying that, how many times have we seen zombie flesh eaters in
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so perhaps that rule doesn't hold true. But what you get in the end with the girl with the dragon tattoo is essentially a bit of a thriller, a psychological crime thriller, where if you imagine that the old great 70s thrillers such as All the President's Men and The Parallax View and The Conversation, these things about guys digging deeper and deeper into circumstances and finding out more and more information. That's what it boils down to. It is like a journalistic thriller, but it's got such dark overtones, and it's all about people's surfaces and never what they seem. You scratch a bit and then you find some dark undercurrent relating to them, and this is something that's inherent in all the characters in the book and the film.
Isn't there some contentious scenes in there as well?
The scenes in there, and I've heard a lot said about them, they are, I would say, that they're very harsh for a mainstream audience. I don't think it's certainly no worse than I've seen in a lot of films. I would say it's pertinent to the story, and I don't think it's gratuitous in any way, shape or form. I think it is entirely relevant. I think if you were going to see this film on a night out and you weren't really perhaps so much involved with seeing foreign films, then I think you might think it was somewhat strong. But in the end, we've got to think about this audience, the people who are going to see this film, and you're not going to have anybody going to see a Swedish film about about death and murder.
Good or bad? Recommended.
Oh, highly recommended.
Okay, we're just going to squeeze in the final one, because we need to talk about this film, because we haven't, and everyone else is talking about it. And that is Paranormal Activity. Now, obviously, depending on which version you've seen, you can have very different outcomes to this film. Now, basically, without giving too much away, the ending I've seen is, I think it's the Spielberg ending.
Right.
Maybe the ending you've seen is the original kind of ending that went to the festivals and bits and pieces.
I think it certainly went to the festivals. I don't even know if the version I saw was theatrical.
Apparently the DVD has got like at least three or four different endings on it. So.
Yeah.
But they probably all suck, let's be honest. Shall we just be honest about where we're coming from on this film?
Yeah, I think what we need to do is perhaps a bit of an introduction, because I think, as you were saying, it came out late last year.
Yeah, it did. Most people have seen it now.
I think due to how much effect this film had, we've had to drag it into our review of this year, just because we need to talk about it. Should we fill people in on the story?
Yeah, bottom line, there's a couple, they live in this not too bad house. That's the kind of most fun I had, was checking out this guy's apartment. But anyway, yeah, they live in this apartment, and basically the girl says that there's been a ghost following her, and it's not in the house, it's more like it's followed her since she was a child. So her boyfriend decides to get a camera and film various different things that happen in the house. And they also get a psychic investigator in, don't they? Who, to be fair, is the best performance in the film.
You think?
Yeah, I think he's so believable, that guy. And I wanted more of him to be hooked in the film.
Yeah.
But whenever he went away, I was just like, back to this kind of couple again.
Really. Yeah.
But yeah, various things happen. The lights come on and off. Door creaks.
Yeah.
We've got some weird thumping sounds going on. all stuff that you could do at home.
Yeah,
apart from there's one scene where a Ouija board, the little bracket thing on a Ouija board moves around, and then it goes on fire, which is probably quite a good optical trick. So, I'm not too sure how they did that.
Yeah, I know. That bit looks good, but it is very...
All in all, you're kind of waiting for these things to happen, aren't you?
You are, absolutely.
And a lot of it takes place in the couple's bedroom in a locked-off shot. So you're kind of looking around the frame for stuff to happen. And obviously, a lot of people got really freaked out by this film. I've got to be honest, I found it funny. There's a couple of scenes in it where I actually had to suppress my laughter in front of my partner, Layla, just because I wanted her to enjoy it without me guffawing for it. But there was a scene where the central female character is dragged out of the bed, which I think worked quite well. But then she's dragged down a corridor, and I don't know, I just found that really funny. And then later on, without giving too much away, we're introduced to a third character, kind of via a sort of video clip on the internet, who'd apparently been possessed and ended up chewing her own arm off, that just happened to be videoed.
Yeah.
You know, and she's there in a bed with this severed arm next to her, which I just thought, well, who's filming that and why haven't they moved the arm? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Too many things like that I just thought were pretty shit. And also, before you interject, there's one bit which I just said to you a moment ago, which I thought was stupid. There's plenty of footage of the girl getting out of bed and just standing near the bed. And apparently that freaked people out because she stood there for like hours.
Yeah.
Where to me that just looked like someone had forward-wind a clock in the corner of the screen. And, you know, the guy's hard drive must have been fucking massive.
Yeah.
To do the ending, which was like, you know, at least 2 days worth of continuous streaming video.
Yeah.
So a lot of it technically didn't work for me.
No, that's it. I think it's... it's something like Horror for Morons, really. Paranormal Activity. What you end up getting is the bits in between are boring. They don't engage you. You barely get any sort of emotional response with the characters. I found it difficult to really care about either of them. Neither of them ever seemed to go to work, which really annoyed me. And then in the end, when things were happening to them, I wasn't really that bothered so much. And in the end, you were saying you thought it was funny.
I did find it quite funny.
Yeah. But I mean, well, you probably got more out of it than I did, because I was just bored. I was just really, really bored. And it's... I don't know. This film...
We require more from a horror film, I think that's what it is. Yeah.
That's
obviously, you know, with the type of people that don't buy into the stuff that comes with a movie, like, you know, this is real.
Yeah.
You know, like the old Blair Witch thing, you know, based on true events. I mean, there's people still wandering around thinking Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a true story, you know? So I think, you know, as long as you research and you kind of, at least a little bit worldly, you're not going to buy into the fact that this is a real film.
No.
You know, it's prefabricated, it's made, you know, and I think once you know that, then it does take a lot of the mystique out of
it. It does. I think that's perhaps the difference, isn't it? Because it's still presented as a real story.
And I think the most fun you have with this film is before you watch it.
Yeah,
because you hear the hype or this intensely scary film and you think, shit, someone's made a film that's probably going to freak me out. And that whole process of being quite excited yet trepidatious about watching a movie, I found was far more rewarding than actually watching the film.
Yeah.
You know, end of the day, go back and watch Cannibal Holocaust for a film that takes you places.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. No, you are absolutely right.
Anything more to say on Paranormal Activity?
No, I hope they don't do Paranormal Activity too, but I'm sure it's already in pre-production.
And in the words of Public Enemy, don't believe the hype.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we're going to rattle off now. We've got 3 minutes left, so we're just going to say news. Apparently, later on in May, maybe we're preempting this a little bit, but it's quite good news. City of Living Dead is getting its Blue Underground Blu-ray release. Now, we were just talking earlier on saying that that's a film that probably we've been waiting to see in high definition for some time, isn't it? I mean, don't get me wrong, the Anchor Bay release that came out on DVD a few years back was obviously much better than a lot of the third generation videotapes that true kind of horror fans had, but I think, yeah, we're pretty much looking forward to catching that on Blu-ray.
And I think we've got some new stuff on there as well. So
there's some extra features on there.
Yeah, this is it, and then we've got Zombie Flesh Eaters to follow. And
really, the Blue Underground doing that as well.
Well, I do know that they're doing a Blu-ray.
So they're kind of pilfering a lot of the old Anchor Bay,
but
releasing it. Excellent, cool. All right, what else can we say? maybe we should talk about some future ideas in the last couple of minutes we've got. I mean, obviously, this issue's been pretty much a bumper issue. We've talked about, what, 9 movies there,
yeah,
which we probably won't be doing in such great detail later on. We're picking a genre or something like that. But yeah, obviously, what's coming out, maybe next month, I'm not really looking forward to, but I know I'm going to end up seeing it, is the new Nightmare on Elm Street movie.
Oh, God,
yeah. You know, from all accounts, the trailer looks pretty bad, and it also looks very much identical to the original film.
Exactly.
Same set piece, same bath scene, same, you know, kind of corpse being dragged off down a school corridor, that's leaving blood everywhere.
Yeah. He's
I haven't seen Mr. Tickle in the corridor.
No, be interested to see whether they pull that one off. But it's another one that just seems like, why remake a film like that? Why do it when you're just going to do exactly the same film, which it looks like it's going
to
be?
But we'll hold out. And we'll no doubt talk about it once we've seen it.
Right.
Now, going back to our video vlogs, which we do on YouTube, Deranged TV, and MySpace, derangedpictures.com, I believe, something like that. Check it out anyway. We'll probably end up doing an Elm Street kind of serial.
Yeah.
And going through the pictures. So keep an eye out for that, and we'll obviously inform you on the podcast as well. All right, anything else we can say before we sign off?
Well, I think it's a matter of, you know, this is our first podcast. It's not going to be great, and, you know...
Brilliant. I think we need a few more cans.
Yeah,
why not? And a bit more to smoke next time.
Yeah, just bear with us. We will... obviously get better. Any feedback you want to give us, what you want to look for, if you go to MySpace, search for Deranged Pictures, all our stuff's on there. Send us any messages you can about this if you hear it, and we'll keep growing and we'll keep doing this because that's what we do.
Stay deranged. See you later.